It's 6-ish on Sunday night. Welcome to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. Tonight my show is all about animals. Unusual ones, exotic ones, animals and creatures that are capable of things we might never have imagined. Consider, for instance, a teeny little amoeba-like blob that lives in the ocean. A vulnerable little creature, but it has something that we humans crave.
One of the most incredible organisms living in the oceans of planet Earth is the Teratopsis dorinii.
Otherwise known as Teratopsis nutricula, otherwise known as the immortal jellyfish.
It is a tiny transparent jellyfish that was first discovered in the 1880s in the Mediterranean Sea, but can be found in many oceans around the world. The thing that makes this strange, almost alien-like creature so incredible is that it is biologically immortal. This means that the creature can be killed, but doesn't seem to die from old age. Most jellyfish species have a relatively fixed lifespan, but this jellyfish is capable of reverting completely to a sexually immature stage after having reached maturity, which is kind of like a butterfly changing back to a caterpillar instead of dying.
Okay, here's the typical life cycle of a jellyfish. We've got the fertilized egg, which becomes a larva, which sinks to the bottom of the ocean, attaches itself to something, and becomes a polyp, which, over time, transforms itself into a free-swimming, bell-shaped medusa, aka jellyfish, with 80 to 90 tentacles. Since Teratopsis is a kind of plankton is, by the way, a word for anything that doesn't really move itself around in the ocean, it just gets moved around by the ocean, but often jellyfish gets eaten by other organisms or killed off by disease, so it's technically not immortal if it gets eaten. But the amazing stuff happens when this dime-sized jellyfish somehow avoids getting eaten, but then can't find enough food or is injured or is otherwise stressed by the environment. This is the point that the jellyfish goes all Benjamin Button on us, throwing its life cycle into reverse. And actually starts creating new polyp cells.
When they become threatened by physical injury or even starvation, the creatures can transform back to a juvenile polyp by retracting their tentacles, shrinking their bodies, and sinking to the ocean floor to start the cycle all over again. Over time, new genetically identical clones of the original jellyfish are released from the polyp into the sea. And incredibly, these can also transform back if threatened, meaning that the process can be repeated over and over.
It is the only animal that we know of that is capable of reverting back to a younger version of itself. What's actually happening here is when mature cells that have already been assigned a function, like lung cells or skin cells, become different kinds of cells. In the case of this jellyfish, that might mean converting a muscle cell into a nerve cell or even a sperm or an egg cell. This process is called transdifferentiation. Among animals, transdifferentiation is not unique to these jellyfish. For example, if you take the lens out of the eye of a chicken, the iris cells will actually develop into lens cells. Unlike the jellyfish, though, the chicken cannot revert its entire body back into an egg. The story of the Teratopsis is important to scientists because we're constantly looking for ways to regenerate new tissue. Usually that process involves stem cells, or unassigned cells that haven't been given genetic instructions to become a nerve cell or a bone cell or a liver cell. Transdifferentiation doesn't require that. The problem is, we have no idea what signals are being sent to these cells to change their type. For now, the Teratopsis remains the only animal that we know of that can regenerate its entire body. We just don't understand how it works. If this thing has cells that can switch themselves on and off when they're in peril, it could prove very useful for cancer research. Imagine if we could isolate a cancer cell and just turn on their young and healthy cell instructions again.
So, one day in the future, humans may live for hundreds or even thousands of years. And this may well be achieved because of the research that went into the tiny blob we know as the immortal jellyfish.
Hey, you build a ladder to the stars. Climb on every round and may you stay forever young. Forever young.
Well, Mr. Dylan, you didn't stay forever young, but you remain, shall we say, sui generis, keeping unusual animals alive, if not forever young, is a vet called Dr. Pilney. He deals in exotic animals. In his case, exotic simply means not your usual cats and dogs. And I'm going to tell you about some of his unusual patients here on Luna's KX935 Share an Hour. That's with me, Sharon James. And I'm quoting from a New York Times article by Andy Newman. That's Andy, not Randy. Here's a typical day in Dr. Pilney's exotic vet office. He's currently treating a pet duck, Dino, a white duck, 3 years old, that lost her ability to form eggshells inside her. So her unlaid eggs were just yolks swilling about. Dr. Pilney removed most of her reproductive hardware, but he left her ovary in there because if he'd taken it out, she could have bled to death. He said, in fact, when you take out the reproductive tract, most ducks will stop ovulating. But this duck broke the rules. And this poor duck, because of her egg yolk problems, had a calcium deficiency. So it meant she had weak bones, which manifested itself in a fractured leg and meant she could no longer walk. So she was crawling around on towels or being carried everywhere by her owner, who was a ballroom dance instructor. $1,200 did this owner invest in this literal lame duck. But there was a reason. She wasn't just any old duck. She was actually a seeing eye duck. For another of this ballroom dancer's ducks, who was blind. That blind duck was called Penguin, and Dino would find food and water and then make some noises to summon Penguin, who would realize that fodder was there and would come over and start eating. Meantime, limping Dino had a clamp on her webbed foot so that Dr. Pilney could monitor her vital signs. The yolks that had fallen loose inside her body had actually formed cysts that attached themselves to her organs. He had to tie off the blood supply to the oviduct. Meantime, the hospital's practice manager was poking her head into the surgery to say that the constipated rabbit that they were also treating might need laser surgery to remove the balloon in his belly. Dr. Pilney was stressed out. Quick reminder here that you're listening to The Share an Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is animals, particularly exotic ones, and I'm currently reviewing A Day in the Life of One Dr. Pilney, an exotic animal veterinarian. Dr. Pilney is one of only three veterinarians at the Center for Avian and Exotic Medicine. One of his colleagues had been bitten by an iguana called Spot while making her morning rounds. The owner of the iguana lives in Hell's Kitchen, and he said, yeah, she's a tough one. She can have a little bit of attitude, but he said he loved her very much. The colleague was bitten said, I always expect an iguana's going to bite. I always assume the worst with them. There's no such thing as a nice iguana. The other colleague had gone off to get her stitches, so Dr. Pilney was all on his own doing his surgery on the duck without any assisting doctor. Meantime, a whole load of other patients were waiting to be seen. A guinea pig with hair loss, a hedgehog who'd lost an eyeball, his eye had to be removed because of an infection, and a chinchilla who'd lost one leg. Sometimes the vet's clients are illegals. Dr. Pilney said, I'm not a big fan of people keeping some of the animals that come in here, but We don't report anybody. We just provide the medical care. Dr. Pilney does his surgery in a tropical-themed surgical cap with parrots and green leaves on it. He's particularly fond of birds. He himself has 15 of them. He saves the brightly covered feathers from his patients in a desk drawer in his office and every now and then sends them to the Pueblo of Zuni in New Mexico, where they make headdresses out of molted plumage. He himself grew up in a less exotic place, in the Bronx. He only treats animals that are under 50 pounds, and as I said, eschews cats and dogs in favour of exotics, because he says cats and birds don't mix. And of course, he's a bird person. His next surgery after the duck was an ovariohysterectomy on a guinea pig. Dr. Pilney noticed that her fur loss was the same on both sides, identical in fact, and symmetrical alopecia is caused by a hormonal imbalance, he knew. So he figured out that was caused by ovarian cysts, hence the planned surgery. The duck's surgery had actually gone reasonably well, and he told the owner that he's not necessarily cured, but it would buy her a good 8 months or a year. Then there was another rabbit as well as the constipated one. This one was brought in for a dental issue, but apparently during the exam its eyes began jerking back and forth, a condition called nystagmus, and then it started running around in circles on the treatment table. Dr. Pilney said, "I told the owner it's either a bizarre coincidence or this is the real problem." The rabbit, after being tested, was treated for a protozoan infection. Meanwhile, the owners of the constipated white rabbit, who was called Snorri, came rushing in, holding the rabbit, which became agitated, moved his bowels, and then collapsed. Snorri's large intestine got so severely bloated that the intestines leaked bacteria into the abdomen and he went into sepsis, Dr. Pilney explained. He said, "I don't understand. It's a young rabbit. That shouldn't have happened." The owners started sobbing. Snorri had actually been born at the centre, and his parents were out in the reception area munching on hay. Tune to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about animals, particularly ones with unusual powers, ones you might not expect in an animal. Take the elephant and that animals' legendary capacity for memory. Here's more on these magnificent creatures from a TED Ed video.
It's a common saying that elephants never forget. But unlike many proverbs, the one about elephant memory is scientifically accurate. Elephants know every member in their herd, able to recognize as many as 30 companions by sight or smell. This is a great help when migrating or encountering other potentially hostile elephants. They also remember and distinguish particular cues that signal danger and can recall important locations long after their last visit. But it's the memories unrelated to survival that are the most fascinating. Elephants remember not only their herd companions, but other creatures who have made a strong impression on them. This recognition isn't limited to others of their species. Elephants have also recognized humans they've bonded with after decades apart.
There's the story of the baby elephant called Nadumi. He was knocked unconscious by tribesmen who were armed with sticks and machetes to protect their crops, and his mother died. He wakes up orphaned, screaming for her, and was adopted by the David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. The trust's head keeper, Joseph Sawney, oversaw Nadumi's rehab. He watched him grow up, gain strength, but then start roaming around with other elephants who occasionally led him into trouble. No one had seen him for many years, and Sawney, who raised him, and the others didn't know whether he was still alive or what was happening with him. Until one day, a very tame elephant wandered onto a film set in Tsavi East National Park, which was the sector that Joseph Sawney was head keeper of. A couple were producing a documentary on wild elephants, and they spotted Nadumi and chronicled his adventures, naming him Chota, not knowing he was Nadumi. But at one point, because the documentarians were longtime friends of this David Sheldrick Wildlife Trust, they called to see if the keepers would come and take a look at this particular elephant. Sawney and a few of his fellow caretakers came out, saw Chota, knew it was Nadumi, and both the keeper and the elephant were thrilled. The elephant started wagging its ears and kicking its trunk up in the dirt. Sawney was ecstatic that Nadumi had recognized him and was well and happy.
This is fantastic. Now we are happy. For many years we've not seen him. It's unbelievable to have seen him now. He is very much okay. I'm really very, very, very much happy. Fantastic to see him alive. This is the greatest present that we got for this day.
I remember you. You're the one who made my dreams come true a few kisses ago. I remember you. You're the one who said I love you too. Yes, I do. Didn't you know? I remember too a distant bell and stars that fell like the rain out of the blue. When my life is through and the angels ask me to recall the thrill of it all, then I will tell them I remember you. A distant bell and stars that fell just like the rain out of the blue. When my life is through and the angels ask me to recall the thrill of it all, then I will tell them I remember. Tell them I remember. Tell them I remember you.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's Kicks 935. Tonight my topic is animals, particularly ones that have traits that we consider unusual in animals. With the elephant, of course, most remarkable is their memory.
Elephant memory goes beyond responses to stimuli. Looking inside their heads, we can see why. The elephant boasts the largest brain of any land mammal, and the elephant's EQ is nearly as high as a chimpanzee's. And despite the distant relation, convergent evolution has made it remarkably similar to the human brain, with as many neurons and synapses in a highly developed hippocampus and cerebral cortex. It is the hippocampus strongly associated with emotion that aids recollection by encoding important experiences into long-term memories. The ability to distinguish this importance makes elephant memory a complex and adaptable faculty beyond rote memorization. It's what allows elephants who survived a drought in their youth to recognize its warning signs in adulthood, which is why clans with older matriarchs have higher survival rates. Unfortunately, it's also what makes elephants one of the few non-human animals to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. The cerebral cortex, on the other hand, enables problem-solving, which elephants display in many creative ways. They also tackle problems cooperatively, sometimes even outwitting the researchers and manipulating their partners. And they've grasped basic arithmetic, keeping track of the relative amounts of fruit in two baskets after multiple changes. The rare combination of memory and problem-solving can explain some of elephants' most clever behaviors. But it doesn't explain some of the things we're just beginning to learn about their mental lives. Elephants communicate using everything from body signals and vocalizations to infrasound rumbles that can be heard kilometers away, and their understanding of syntax suggests that they have their own language and grammar. This sense of language may even go beyond simple communication. Elephants create art by carefully choosing and combining different colors and elements. They can also recognize 12 distinct tones of music and recreate melodies. And yes, there is an elephant band. But perhaps the most amazing thing about elephants is a capacity even more important than cleverness: their sense of empathy, altruism, and justice. Elephants are the only non-human animals to mourn their dead, performing burial rituals and returning to visit graves. They have shown concern for other species as well. One working elephant refused to set a log down into a hole where a dog was sleeping, while elephants encountering injured humans have sometimes stood guard and gently comforted them with their trunk. On the other hand, elephant attacks on human villages have usually occurred right after massive poachings or cullings, suggesting deliberate revenge. When we consider all this evidence, along with the fact that elephants are one of the few species who can recognize themselves in a mirror, it's hard to escape the conclusion that they are conscious, intelligent, and emotional beings. In one case, two circus elephants that had briefly performed together rejoiced when crossing paths 23 years later.
To Bombay, a traveling circus came. They brought an intelligent elephant, and Nelly was her name. One dark night, she slipped her iron chain, and off she ran to Hindustan and was never seen again. Her trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump. Nellie the elephant packed her trunk and trundled back to the jungle. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump. The head of the herd was calling far, far away. They met one night in their silver light on the road to Mandalay. So Nellie the elephant packed her trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump. She died. dance to the circus band. When Nellie was leading the big parade, she looked so proud and grand. No more tricks for Nellie to perform. They taught her how to take a bow when she took the crowd by storm. And packed her trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump. Nellie the elephant packed her trunk and trundled back to the jungle. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump. The head of the herd was calling far, far away. They met one night in the silver light on the road to Mandalay. So Nellie the elephant packed her trunk and said goodbye to the circus. Off she went with a trumpety trump, 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 trump.
You are listening to The Share Now with me, Sharon James, on Luna's KX 93.5. Tonight I'm talking about animals and animal life, specifically exotic ones you may not know about, ones that do wondrous and terrible things. How about the hairy frog? Have you heard of the hairy frog? Also known as the horror frog or the wolverine frog, which gives some indication of its nature, which really has little to do with its hairiness, which is only on the side of its body, oddly.
It's actually not really hair, but thin, skin-like structures that protrude from its body that looks like hair. But what makes this frog so amazing, it's its claws. Its claws are made of bone that it can project through its skin by breaking its toe bones. The frog breaks its own bones to grow claws. When the frog feels threatened or under attack, it will push these broken bones out of its feet to produce claws. As the bone pushes outward, a bone nodule close to the outside of the foot adds a sharp point to the frog's bones, making them look and act just like claws. And unlike all other animals with claws, the wolverine frog's claws are not covered in a protective coating of keratin. These frogs are attacking with their actual bones. Scientists aren't certain if the bones ever retract after they have broken through the skin, but considering the wolverine frog's amazing ability, it's likely that over time the bones recess back into the foot until they are needed again.
Wow, it's like pulling your own teeth. Then there's the punchy little mantis shrimp, which becomes quite giant with its punch.
Even though they are only 4 inches long, they are one of the strongest animals in the world. The mantis shrimp have clubs they use to punch and destroy their prey. The shrimp has developed a complex muscular structure that actually winds up the shrimp's punching arm like a spring. When the shrimp is ready to attack, it releases the spring-loaded club with the force of a bullet shot from a .22 caliber gun. The punch accelerates over 50 miles per hour with a force of over 330 pounds. That's up to 2,500 times the shrimp's own weight. Scientists have to keep these shrimp in thick plastic tanks because their punch can easily smash glass. If a person could hit that hard, they could break steel. Besides the actual clubs, the force and speed the shrimp uses to attack creates bubbles that are so strong that they act like a shockwave, stunning the prey first, then knocking it down.
Just kidding, but in fact, the truth is,
in essence, a mantis shrimp punch acts and feels like multiple hits, even though it's just one stroke. In order to punch that hard without breaking their clubs, mantis shrimp have a special shock-absorbent core called a Bulligan structure. This keeps small cracks from breaking completely. Researchers are trying to imitate this structure to design thin, light materials strong enough to stop explosives.
Okay, no show on fascinating exotic creatures, and that is the topic of my KX 935 Sharon out tonight, would be complete without a mention of the ant. So I think of ants as maybe the most selfless and community-oriented creatures on the earth. They seem so diligent. They seem to be looking out for each other, working hard to serve each other, even at their own peril sometimes. But every species has its monsters, I suppose, and the kamikaze ant would fit that bill, certainly from the outside looking in, from its potential victim looking in. If you think the fire ant is bad, you ain't met the kamikaze.
The fire ant might have a painful sting, but just wait until you meet its cousin, the Malaysian exploding ant, also known as the kamikaze ant. The Malaysian ant looks like a regular ant, but the soldiers carry a deadly weapon. The ant has poisonous sacs from its mandible to its abdomen. If it feels threatened, the soldier ant will contract its muscles and literally explode, spraying the poison on its enemy by squeezing itself to death. The poison is like a glue to their enemies. When the ant explodes, the poison and the dead ant are permanently stuck to their attacker, who may then suffer a slow and painful death.
Or something to that effect.
The soldier ant takes its job very seriously. Scientists have witnessed the kamikaze soldier ant leave the safety of its colony and run off to protect not only their home, but their foraging areas. This ant is the only known animal in the animal kingdom that will protect its kind from so far away through self-sacrifice.
So, still a team player, albeit a monster. And then there's this.
In between a predator and a parasite lies the parasitoid wasp, a special type of parasite that helps to control pests from getting out of control. What makes these wasps so successful is their ability to zombify their host. Their venom blocks the chemical octopamine that controls the insect's motor functions.
Nice.
Once the host is zombified, the wasp can do whatever it wants with the newly made zombie. The wasp lays eggs inside or on top of its host.
Great. Then it gets worse.
When the larvae emerge, they begin eating their host alive.
Too much, eh?
Each species of wasp chooses a different type of host, like caterpillars, ants, bees, ladybugs, flies, cockroaches, and even spiders. In these wasps, it is the eggs that control the host. Instead of building a cocoon, they continue to control their host as they develop, using it as a bodyguard for the cocoons. When they hatch, the larva will stay inside the body. Then, when the larva is fully developed, it bursts out of the host body, just like Alien.
Friendly aliens. You're tuned to The Sharer Now, and me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5, talking about animals, particularly exotic ones tonight, including ones you may not have heard of. Okay, so picture the ugliest pig you ever saw combined with a hairless rat, and you have...
the naked mole rat. This subterranean rodent native to East Africa can live up to 30 years. While it may be ugly, Science magazine chose this animal as vertebrate of the year because of its resistance to pain and cancer. The mole rat is practically blind and uses hairs to navigate through the tunnels. They have two long and sharp front teeth located outside of their jaw directly on their face. This helps the animal dig through the tunnels without getting dirt in its mouth. They live in a eusocial society where the mole rats are ruled by a single queen like an ant colony, which is very rare in mammals. They have a substance on their skin called hyaluronin that helps with cell replication and elasticity, making it resistant to tumors. Scientists have been studying the naked mole rat in hopes of finding a cure for cancer. Along with the research into the animal's cancer resistance, it was discovered that the mole rat is impervious to pain. When the animal is born, it develops a strong amino acid chain that runs through its nervous system, inhibiting the animal's neuroreceptors from feeling pain.
It doesn't matter now what you do. Get a hold of yourself. Crying ain't gonna help you none.
little creatures that you'd think could quite easily be hurt, but turn out to be the strongest creatures on Earth, just about. Real supermen, adaptable, virtually invulnerable to the elements anyway. Here's one of those strange exotic creatures that belong under the topic of my KX935's Sharon Hour tonight, which is all about strange exotic creatures. Have you heard of the tardigrade? I hadn't.
The tardigrade, aka the water bear, is considered nature's toughest animal and is impossible to kill. Tardigrades are small aquatic creatures that can be found almost everywhere in the world. Their superpower is their ability to survive super extreme conditions. Scientists have experimentally subjected these creatures to minus 272.95 degrees Celsius, otherwise known as absolute zero, for 20 months, and then to 150 degrees Celsius. They have been subjected to more than 40,000 kilopascals of pressure and dangerous concentrations of carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, sulfur dioxide, and still they return to active life. They went aboard the U.S. shuttlecraft The Endeavour, where the animals even survived the burning ultraviolet radiation of space.
Oh, Superman. Oh, John. Okay, who is this really? And the voice said, this is the hand that takes. This is the hand.
Was my tardigrade theme song selection. I hope Laurie Anderson approves. You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, talking tonight about unusual animals, creatures that you may not have heard of that seem to have superpowers, some of them. So you certainly should have heard of them, certainly.
The tardigrade. Inside these tiny beasts, we find anatomy and physiology similar to that of larger animals, including a full alimentary canal and digestive system. When faced with extreme conditions, tardigrades can dry out completely, replacing almost all of the water in their bodies with a sugar. As a result, they're able to survive environments that would otherwise kill them. Once the tardigrade senses it is in a safe place to live, it will plump back up by absorbing the water around it. It's through this reabsorption process that the tardigrade grabs genetic material from its surroundings. 17.5% of its genome comes from other species.
Okay, here's another mad and wonderful exotic animal. Versatile, too.
Just like its name suggests, what makes the mimic octopus special is its ability to mimic other creatures. It will take on the colors, shapes, and movements of known predators in order to travel safely around. It has been known to mimic up to 15 different animals, including jellyfish, eels, sea snakes, dragonfish, sole, mantis shrimp, and stingrays.
Chameleon, then, the mimic octopus. Well, no, more a mimic octopus. One of the exotic creatures that's the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5.
The mimic octopus is highly intelligent and it has found a way to fight off threats it may come across by learning how to act like its predator's predator. For example, when moving into an area full of deadly for it, damselfish, it will mimic a sea snake because it knows that the sea snake is the damselfish's worst enemy. Scientists say that the mimic octopus is the only known species to mimic more than just one animal. What is even more fascinating is that the octopus doesn't only take on the shape and color of other animals, but also its movement. It will sit with two tentacles in a prayer position to imitate a mantis shrimp, lay flat on the ocean floor to mimic a sole, and it will scurry about sideways to act like a crab.
Step right up for the eight-legged lady, eh? You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is animals, and I've been talking about exotic ones, ones we know very little about. But the ones we're really curious about are the ones we've adopted as pets, particularly our dogs, because they want us to know them. But how do we really know what they're thinking? They are another species. We don't even know what our own species are thinking half the time. But we do have ways of measuring it with other human beings, at least measuring what is actually going on physiologically. And there's one man, Dr. Jeffrey Burns, who's trying to do the same with dogs. I'll let him tell you about it in his own words from his TEDx talk.
Well, I got into this project. It really started with a dog named Newton, who was really my favorite dog. I've had many dogs through my life, but Newton was my favorite, and he lived to be about 15 years old. And after he passed away, I thought, you know, I have these tools, this MRI machine that I've been using for decades to study human decision-making and what motivates people. Why haven't we used this on other animals? Certainly other animals have many of the same feelings and motivations that people do. And so I embarked on this project about 4 years ago to try to figure out what dogs think, and specifically what dogs think of us. Now, if we're talking about humans, we have kind of two ways we can think about what other people are thinking. We can either ask them, and sometimes they will tell us if they know and they want us to know what they're thinking, or we can observe actions and we can observe behaviors and we can try to infer things about what people are thinking from their actions. With animals and dogs, of course, we can't really ask them. We really don't know what they're thinking, and so we're kind of left with their behaviors. We can observe their actions and we can try to infer what they're thinking. Now, this is the foundation of behaviorism, and it's been around since Pavlov. But there are, of course, very tricky issues here, and humans being humans, we tend to anthropomorphize everything. So it's in this area that I became very interested and intrigued with the possibility of trying to figure out what dogs are thinking by using MRI. The technique is straightforward. It's been around for decades. If we were studying a human, we would put a human in an MRI, have them do some type of task, and we'd measure blood flow or brain activity, and then try to figure out what parts of the brain do what. Very straightforward. If you've had an MRI, it's not terribly pleasant, but people will do it. So how do we do this with other animals? How do we do it with a dog? Well, I'm going to show you, and then I'll show you what we found.
Okay, here's where radio fails us somewhat, because it's an audio-only medium. This particular one is Laguna's own and only FM radio station, KX935. I'm Sharon James, and this my show is called The Sharon Hour. What Dr. Burns is showing his TEDx audience here is a training video, training two dogs to willingly insert themselves into an MRI machine so that their brain patterns can be studied.
The first dog, Callie, is my dog. She was actually the replacement for Newton, and she was adopted from the Humane Society. We loved Newton so much, we could never get another pug, so Callie is the anti-pug. The other dog is Mackenzie, a border collie. And the first thing that we had to do is figure out, how do we get dogs to go into a tube, put a head coil around their head to pick up the brain waves, and hold absolutely still. Now, Mackenzie, a border collie, is highly trained. She's very skilled in agility, and her owner gets her to sit in this coil very quickly. Callie is not a particularly obedient dog. She has no particularly special skills, but she does have one good trait, and that is she likes hot dogs. Now, Mark
Spivek is a dog trainer assisting Dr. Burns with this experiment.
Is doing what we call clicker training. So every time she approximates what we want her to do, he clicks, and then she gets a hot dog. This is the very first time she's been introduced to the thing we call the head coil. And so we didn't know at this point whether this was even going to be possible. If you've had an MRI, you know that you're told not to move, right? And this is the big challenge of doing this. We get charged about $500 an hour to use the MRI.
Meaning you can't be mucking around waiting for the dog to do what it's supposed to do, plus stay still after.
So what we did was we introduced a little chin rest because we have to give the dogs a target to put their head on. And Mackenzie adapts to this very quickly, and she's doing quite well, but this is actually still too much movement. So we've made some modifications to the chin rest, and even a shelter dog like Callie can do this. But the really difficult part of this is the noise that a scanner makes. It's very loud. This is being played at low volume just to get her used to it. But it's really about 95 decibels. It's like jackhammer loud. So she's wearing earmuffs because the scanner is so loud and the dog's hearing is quite sensitive. And the key thing is that these dogs are doing it willingly and they enjoy it. And that is the whole point of this project. We treat these animals as family members. We don't sedate them and we don't restrain them. So the other thing that we did, and this is just straight up Pavlovian conditioning, where we taught the dogs two hand signals. This means hot dog.
The trainer puts his hand up.
And this means no hot dog.
The trainer puts his fingers tip to tip to make a barrier with his hands.
So what we should see is activity in the rewards parts of their brain, the reward system. And what we're studying initially is the reward system response. This hand signal, hot dog, but not this signal, no hot dog. We have many dogs doing this now. It's not just shelter dogs. We have dogs from service dog organizations. We have shelter dogs, really all sorts of breeds. Now, a dog brain is probably about the size of a plum or a lemon, maybe, depending on the size of the dog. It's not big. So even if you have a big dog, most of the head is muscle. So just kind of be aware of that. But I like the similarities of animal brains, kind of common structures. There's the cerebellum that controls various types of motor movement. And then below that, there's the brain stem. And really, the parts of the brain that are different are what we call the cortex. That's the upper part, the folded part. And the big differences between dog and human have to do with the size of the cortex and how folded it is. What folding accomplishes is packing a lot more brain surface area into a specific volume. So generally speaking, the more folded a brain, the more surface area, the more brain power, if you will. So there's lots of similarities and there's some differences. What I'm particularly interested in are the similarities, because if we're to have a commonality of experience with dogs and other animals for that matter, we have to share the same or similar brain structures. Darwin said this 150 years ago.
Maybe our most common affiliation is with dogs, but of course we are evolved from primates. And funnily enough, they did an experiment also using reward system with monkeys. They were basically giving two monkeys cucumber slices as a reward. The monkeys were supposed to hand over a pebble, and in return they got this slice of cucumber. But then they changed the reward with one of the monkeys and gave the monkey a grape. Monkeys love grapes. So when they tried to give the other monkey the regular cucumber, which he'd always loved before, now that he'd seen that the other monkey got a grape, something better, he refused the cucumber slice in a sulk, turned his back on it. And it proved that monkeys, at least, share with us a sense of fairness. So we are finding out that animals can have quite sophisticated minds that are capable of deduction, that are capable of irritation when things are unequal, if you will. Anyway, back to this experiment on dogs, trying to discover what dogs think by putting them into an MRI machine. Experiment reported by Dr. Burns in a TEDx talk and repeated here on tonight's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lunis KX935. Here again, Dr. Burns with the results of the MRIs.
Okay, so what do the results look like? Now, what I want to emphasize is the brain response is not directly to hot dogs, it's to the hand signal that means hot dogs. And you may think, well, that's not a big deal. It's still hot dogs, right? And it's no surprise that dogs like hot dogs. But it is a big deal because we train this signal. It's a symbolic representation of a hot dog that the dog has learned and has learned to recognize this meaning. And the particular parts of the brain that are being active are the reward system. Those kind of two hot spots, those area of the brain called the caudate nucleus. And it's the area of the brain that all mammals have, and it's the area that has the most dopamine receptors in the brain. It's kind of the key center that links reward and motivation with action. So normally, when that's active in a human or really any other animal, it means that something important has happened and the animal needs to do something. In this case, it's quite simple because they will just eat the hot dogs. So what? So we proved that dog brains like hot dogs. Well, that was just the beginning. We've since gone on and done many other experiments, how their olfaction or their sensory system for smell works, how they identify different people and other dogs in their household by smell. And one of the things that we found, for example, is that this reward system, the same part of the brain, activates when the dogs smell a familiar human, even if the human's not there. And so it shows that dogs have representations of us, of our identities, that persist when we're not there. And so When people ask me, well, do dogs miss us when we're gone? I have to say yes, because we find evidence that they are remembering their humans, that they care about them, and that it's associated with these reward responses. So is it still just hot dogs? To answer this question, one of the other things that we did was we actually repeated the experiment where we showed the different hand signals with one little twist. We manipulate who gives the signals. So does it matter if the dog's owner gives the signal, or whether a stranger comes in and gives the signal, or even whether a computer gives the signal? Because if you believe Pavlov and all the behaviorists who followed him, it really shouldn't matter, because any signal that indicates an upcoming food treat is all the same if animals are and dogs are just kind of robots. But in fact, we did find a difference. And what's very interesting about it is that not all dogs are the same. So, for example, my dog Callie had a much greater response in that part of the brain when a stranger gave the signals, or even a computer, as opposed to me. Other dogs in the project, some of the golden retrievers in the labs, kind of had the opposite pattern, where their owners really elicited the strongest brain response. This is very interesting, because what it does is it provides us with a neural biomarker of a dog's personality profile. And in fact, what we've done is we've spun off a new project. We've partnered with Canine Companions for Independence, which is the largest service dog training organization in the United States. So we've partnered with CCI, and they are actually training their dogs to do the MRI procedure. And what we're going to do is try to predict which of those dogs will actually be good service dogs. If you know anything about service dogs, they are incredibly difficult to train. It's very expensive, and there's a very low success rate. Roughly about 35% of dogs that enter these programs to train to be assistance dogs will succeed, and the other two-thirds end up being released and adopted to their puppy raisers. Dogs are special. They are the first domesticated animals. They have been with humans since humans have been humans. And so when we look at their brains, it's almost like we're looking back in time, and it's giving us a picture of how the dog-human bond formed.
Well, that's it from me and the animals for tonight. You've been listening to KX935's Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James. And if you'd like to hear this show again, it podcasts on our website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. You can also listen on iTunes. And do come back for more topics and conversations every Sunday night at 6. This is Sharon James of the Sharon Hour, wishing you a wonderful week ahead.